Hey, I'm Eric Torenberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. Our guest this week is Peter Diamandis, author of Bold, How to Go Big, Create Wealth, and Impact the World, and also co-founder of XPRIZE, Singularity Institute, and many others. This episode, we chat about Peter's story, lessons he's learned from Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Richard Branson, Larry Page, and what's enabled him to succeed across industries in everything from space travel to human longevity to education of the future. All right, here's Peter. So Peter, the book is Bold, How to Go Big, Create Wealth, and Impact the World. Why this book and why now?
So my previous book was called Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think, and it was a book focused on showing how the world was getting better at an extraordinary rate, how over the last 100 years we've decreased poverty massively on the planet, how we've tripled the per capita income for every nation on the planet, doubled the human lifespan, reduced the cost of food 13-fold, energy 20 to 50-fold, communications thousands of fold. And all of these things transform every aspect of our life, how we work, the businesses we start. And ultimately, the question was, what do you do with this and where do you go? And Bold was a second follow-on book to Abundance that shows us as entrepreneurs how we have access to the world's most powerful technologies. Literally, as an entrepreneur today, you have access to more capabilities than the U.S. government and top corporations had 20, 25 years ago. And how can you use this to solve the world's biggest problems and create extraordinary wealth?
And one thing that's interesting about, you know, the book is that you say that this isn't accessible to people. It is accessible to people who also cannot code or don't have, you know, super technological skills. Elaborate more a bit about that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that people shortchange themselves and say, oh, well, how can I possibly do that? Well, ultimately, the single most important thing that anyone who wants to do something big and bold in the world, create wealth, help a billion people and so forth, is you need to have passion for something. That is probably the scarcest resource, you know, the passionate and committed human mind. And then be curious and be able to find stuff. There are so many coders. There are so many mathematicians. There are so many physicists who are brilliant at what they do, but couldn't market themselves worth a damn, could never raise a dollar, could never go and come up with a product. So it's really, how do you tap into those resources? Because we're living in this hyper-connected world where if you've got a vision for what you want to do, you can, through this hyper-connected world, find a great coder, find a great designer, find a great whatever it is, and pull a team together. You know, I've had about 17 startups over the years. I'm very proud of them. Many of them are doing well. One of them is a university called Singularity University up in the Bay Area. And we have graduate students, about 5,000 to 8,000 applicants every year from 80 countries around the world. And they come to SU and they study all the exponentially growing technologies. We select 80 of those students. And during the course of the 10-week program, our mission is to get them to pick a world, a billion-person problem, a problem that's facing a billion people, and begin a product, a service, a company to impact that problem. And I'm fond of saying, listen, if you want to become a billionaire, help a billion people. The world's biggest problems are the world's biggest business opportunities. And so that's the world we're living in today. You can, in fact, create something that has the scalability to impact the world.
Let's analyze your story for a bit. Looking back, you know, you mentioned 17 companies, a lot of them different, you know, different spaces, like actually space, I can't even begin to enumerate. There are a lot of different categories. How do you make sense of, you know, what was your passion? What was your competence that led you to do this?
Well, so I grew up, my parents were both immigrants from Greece. My dad came over and became a doctor here, had gone to medical school there, but had to repeat a lot of it back here in New York. And I grew up expecting to become a doctor. My parents thought I'd be a doctor. My sister became a doctor. I ultimately did become a doctor, but never practiced. But it was really space that got me passionate. You know, I grew up during the tail end of Apollo and during Star Trek, and had, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid, or I should say I drank the Tang, and had an expectation that I would be able to open up that frontier. And I was driven by that passion, driven by that desire to be part of the human race's expansion beyond the Earth during my lifetime. And that drove me to do everything I needed to do, all my educational, all of my, you know, companies I've started, you know, sort of go back to that. So whenever I'm talking to entrepreneurs or grad students or anybody, I say, you know, do you know what your passion is? Do you know what you would do regardless of your parents, your teachers, your employer, whatever, if you had the money and could just go off and do something meaningful with your life? What would it be? And then go do that. You know, a friend of mine just shared a quote with me that I love. He said, find what you would die for and then go live for it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But what would you tell me, you know, for example, when I was 17, my answer would have been basketball. And you can't see me right now, but I'm a 5'9", very frail, unathletic kid. You know, what do you tell someone when their passion doesn't really align with what the world needs or what they're best at?
Well, I would say you can make a career out of anything, including basketball, just not, you know, probably not playing basketball. But the fact of the matter is, I'll give you an example. A dear friend of mine is named Richard Garriott. I first met his dad, Owen Garriott, when I was an undergrad at MIT, because Owen was flying. He was an Apollo and Skylab astronaut and then got into the shuttle program, and he was training in the shuttle program. And I met Richard, who basically barely graduated high school. And during high school, he was a video game player. He loved video games. And then he started designing video games. But he never went to college. And you have to understand, where he was growing up in Houston, everybody had a couple of PhDs, and, you know, school and university was like the thing you would do. So consequently, when Richard decided not to go to school and started building video games and video game companies, he became extraordinarily successful and eventually sold one of his companies north of $100 million, and he bought a ticket to go to the privately to the space station. And so he became the first second-generation astronaut. But here's someone who'd say, on the flip side, oh my God, my kid doesn't apply himself. He's not going to college. What is he going to do? I mean, I've got a PhD. You know, he's extraordinarily successful and brilliant. So you can create a career out of anything these days. It just has to be driven by it. It has to be your passion. Then find the niche that really is unique and something where you can add real value.
You talked a little bit in other interviews and I believe in the book a bit about how our education system isn't, you know, to put it mildly, isn't best doing that today, isn't encouraging us to find our passion, to utilize our, you know, skill sets. You know, how has your thinking evolved on, you know, what can happen in terms of K-12 education, what the opportunities are, and where, you know, you and your abilities and resources can play a role in it if of interest?
So I have 2 4-year-old twin boys. So I'm thinking about this and living it right now. And I'm fond of saying that the most important things I want to teach them is finding their passion. And the way to do that is to expose them to as many things as possible and not have any pre-expectations. But it's letting them be excited about the world and basically find these things. The second is curiosity, is having them follow their curiosity. Because in a world where we've got artificial intelligence and Google and 3D printing and robotics, memorizing facts and being an expert in solving equations isn't going to be the differentiator. It's going to be the person who can ask the smartest questions and be the most curious and track things down to ground and work with technology and such. So, you know, I want a place where my kids can color outside the lines and follow their passions and really be pushed, versus rote memorization and, you know, in a very structured fashion. I mean, structure is important for a young mind, because we do live in a structured society, but it's a balance. It's not all, you know, it used to be that in the old days, school would be, you know, 100 years ago, you would go, you'd go to school, you'd get your degree by the time you were 22. And that would serve you for the next 25 years, because nothing would change that much until you died. because the average age was like 50. And today, it's nothing like that, right? Today, by the time you graduate college, what you started learning in the beginning is out of date, and our life expectancies are going, you know, to double and triple again.
Right. What type of education do you want to give to your kids?
That's a great question, and I'm not 100% sure I know yet. My parents, their grandparents started them I think it's called a 1029 college account, you know, where they put money away, tax deductible and so forth. I said, I don't know if 14 years from now, college is the best thing for them. Maybe, you know, maybe it's not. And so we'll see.
Especially college as we know it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Since releasing the book, you know, you released in February, what surprised you most about the reception to it?
The reception's been great. It hit the top of the New York Times bestseller. I was more surprised to the reception of its predecessor, Abundance, which painted this very positive future that we're heading towards. And I expected to have a lot more naysayers, a lot more pushback. And so we basically, you know, the book is filled with technical, detailed examples and numbers and patterns and, you know, I think 150 charts in the back of the book showing how things are changing. And we got such little pushback, it shocked me. Bold is something which I've had a lot of very successful entrepreneurs read the book and say, man, oh man, I wish I had read this before, but it's still an inspiration for me in this company or my next company.
If you were 25 right now in 2015, what would you be doing?
I think right now, and I have, by the way, a team of five or six 25-year-olds who work for me. I call them my strike force, and they work across all of my companies with me. And so this millennial mindset is something I deal with all the time. I would be saying, again, figure out what you're passionate about. But if I were saying, where do I go and focus, machine learning is for sure one of the most, you know, data, big data, machine learning, whatever you want to call it, is a huge area. And then it's really how these different exponential technologies are converging. You know, it's not just becoming an expert in AI or in 3D printing or synthetic biology. It's the convergence of these technologies where the interesting stuff lays. I mean, blockchain technologies, Bitcoin is a huge area of interest. I know a lot of people focusing on that. I mean, it really is passion-driven. And trying to understand how all these rapidly growing, exponentially changing technologies are going to change the field that you so passionately care about.
You mentioned your passion is space, but given your other companies, you really extended beyond that. And it seems that one thing you're passionate about is, you know, innovation broadly and building communities that connect people together. And you're able to start these companies and also bring other amazing people in. What do you think you uniquely understand about building communities? Or what skills do you uniquely have to bring these people together that other people can learn from?
So, I mean, first, you know, these companies have all come as a result of a lot of hard work. I mean, the 17 companies, I'm actively engaged in running five companies right now, XPRIZE, Singularity University, Human Longevity and Planetary Resources, and then PhD Ventures, which is sort of my umbrella company.
Can you say a sentence about them just real quick?
Yeah, sure. So XPRIZE Foundation, hopefully folks have heard about it. I serve as the chairman and CEO. We put up large global competitions, $10 million, $30 million, and say the first person to solve this problem wins. And the first prize we had was for a three-person spaceship to 100 kilometers altitude twice in 2 weeks. It was won by Burt Rutan and Paul Allen, and Virgin Galactic, Richard Branson's company, was a spin out from that. Singularity University is up in the Bay Area, and it is a graduate and executive program for the study of exponential technologies. We incubate about 20 startups a year, and we have an accelerator for another 20 startups a year using exponential technologies to solve billion-person problems. And it's an amazing, amazing experience. It's singularityu.org. XPRIZE.org is the website for XPRIZE. Human Longevity is my most recent startup. It was announced about 18 months ago. We have built the world's largest genome sequencing facility in the world. We've sequenced more human genomes than the rest of the world combined. We've sequenced more microbiomes, the bacteria in your body, 100 trillion of them. And then we do a mass amount of data mining. It's co-founded with Craig Venter, the top genomicist on the planet, and Bob Hariri, one of the top stem cell entrepreneurs on the planet. And we're focused on adding 30 to 40 healthy years onto everyone's lifespan using machine learning and big data and large data sets of millions of people's full genome and their healthcare records. Planetary Resources is a company up in Seattle I'm co-chairman of, co-founder, and it's a company that focuses on building super capable, very cheap deep space drones with an initial focus of actually being able to use these drones to go out to near-Earth asteroids, asteroids that were discovered in the last 15 years. These asteroids are, so to speak, the low-hanging fruit. These are trillion-dollar assets rich in platinum and fuels. And then PhD Ventures is my company where I do my keynote speaking, my books. And then I run an event called Abundance 360 where I coach about 250 CEOs. And that's just a360.com. And we do that every year where I'm trying to help CEOs see this is the tech that's deceptive right now. That's going to disrupt it this year. This is what you need to be looking at. And all of these are, you know, to go back to your original question, these are all passion-driven. And I find people who I deeply respect, who I love working with, and pull them together, and we'll start a company.
When you bring people together, how do you evaluate whether these are the right people? You know, are there litmus tests that you have or interview questions, or how do you make sure you've got the right people that can run this company?
Well, I mean, first of all, in the case with Craig Venter and Bob Hariri, they're both world-class, amazing individuals. With Planetary Resources, Eric Anderson, my co-founder, and I had been working for 20 years together. Eric was an intern for me in the early days and just saw a brilliant individual, super hardworking. And then Chris Lewicki, who was our first hire, ran three Mars missions. He landed, designed, built, flew, landed Spirit, Opportunity, and Phoenix on the surface of Mars. Doesn't get better than that. But my general sense is that the best predictor of someone's future is what they've done. And it's, you know, what have they done to date? Who is the person they've been? How, what kind of risks have they taken? How hard have they worked? And when you can understand that, you have a reasonably good predictor of where they're gonna go.
What's your philosophy in terms of surrounding yourself with great people? Like, what advice would you give to other entrepreneurs who are similarly looking to surround themselves with amazing and super talented people?
So one of the things I talk about in bold is it's all about mindset. Your mindset matters extraordinarily, and your mindset's a function of the people you hang out with and the environment you're in. So I feel very, very lucky that I get to hang out at Singularity University, at XPRIZE Foundation, at Planetary Resource and HLI. And these are companies, organizations, and communities of people talking about doing crazy, big, world-changing, bold things that are, you know, considered impossible by most people. And it's normal conversation. And that's fun and fantastic. So, you know, where is that? You're not going to jump from, if you're low on that measure of abundance-minded, bold-minded people in your life or in your community, you're not going to go from one end to the other, but you can stop hanging out with the person who's bumming you out all the time. And you can identify who in your circle of friends are the ones that are the ones pushing you and opening your mind and positive mindset, all of this, and hang out more with them. You can also, you know, make sure the environment you're in, whether it's your office. My office is, you know, if I'm looking around right now, I've got a 3D printed, I scanned my brain and 3D printed it. I've got rocket ships and laser guns and all kinds of toys and things around it. I'm a kid. I'm a 9-year-old kid having a blast.
Yeah. And when you know, you're running five companies now, how do you balance your time? How do you say, make sure that you're not spreading yourself too thin? What's your philosophy on that?
Well, the first thing is, of course, I am spread too thin. So that's for sure. The second is, you know, when I say running, I'm involved in running. HLI has a great CEO in Craig Venter, Planetary Resources, Chris Lewicki. But I take a role typically of chairman or co-chairman, help start it. And so I'm involved, and I really try and figure out where am I going to be most useful. And what am I going to do that actually moves the ball forward? I'm not a person sitting inside a meeting for 3 hours looking at the budget. That's just not me. So I know finally what I love doing and what I'm useful at doing, and I try and do more of that.
And what is that? Is that the bringing people together? Is that the noticing opportunities?
Yeah, I think it's brainstorming how to solve big problems. It's bringing people together. It's creating a passionate vision. It's pushing people to think beyond their limits. I mean, remember the first meeting I had with Chris Lewicki at Planetary Resources, I was like, I went to the whiteboard and I drew a box about the size of a shoebox. I said, listen, tech is going to be doubling in price performance and reduction in size and performance every year. So we need to like look out 3-4 years and pick a box and start designing for that instead of doing it the same old way. And you can always make things cheaper and you can always make them smaller and you can always make them more mass producible. So let's forget about how things were done in the ways, the traditional aerospace ways, which is so broken, and reinvent how we do it.
We talked about, you know, strengths, you know, identifying key opportunities, bringing people together. What would you say is a key weakness? And do you believe in shoring up key weaknesses, or do you believe in focusing on your strengths?
I definitely believe in focusing on your strengths. I think, you know, if you try and go and shore up your key weaknesses and so forth, that's probably a waste of time. It's much better to shore that up by finding a partner who's great and passionate about those areas that you're not, and focus on becoming the very best person in one key field that matters more than anything else, and that's your asset. So I become extremely great at raising capital. So that helps me start all my companies, and that's a strength. And, you know, I couldn't look at the work a CPA does if my life depended on it. But I don't care. I hire great CPAs.
Right. And a lot of people here are entrepreneurs looking to raise money. What makes someone great at raising capital?
Probably the most important thing is really truly believing what you're doing. You know, when someone is going to give you money, I think of someone investing you as a transfer of confidence. They are transferring energy to you. They're transferring confidence. They have to believe in you and believe in what you're doing, and they're willing to back you. So your ability to, A, be a great storyteller, which in the positive sense, being able to capture a person's imagination, tell the history, tell where you are, tell the vision where it's going, that's not to be taken for granted. Being a great storyteller is really important. And then really truly believing what you're doing. And I know on a few occasions where I've tried to just go out and make money, you know, start a company because I thought it'd be great, you know, the traditional get rich quick scam, or not scam, but get rich quick concept, failed miserably. Because if you're not super passionate about what you're doing, you're going to give up before you succeed, because you could be lucky, but most of the time it's hard work. So at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're staring yourself at the mirror, damn, if you don't believe it in your heart of hearts, if you're not doing it for yourself, you're not going to push through. So if you're doing something for someone else, if you're doing something because you think it's a quick buck, forget it. Life's too short. Go and do something else.
Right. Now, the book came out a few months ago and you've had time to think about it. What's not in the book, or what's something that you wanted to put in but couldn't for whatever reason, or something that you would put in if it came out today?
Well, so I think the only thing that wasn't ready for prime time that was not in the books was crowdfunding of startups. We talk about reward-based funding. We talk about a whole chapter on how do you do a Kickstarter campaign or an Indiegogo campaign. And shortly after the book, and we talk a little bit about the idea of raising capital from the crowd. And in the last months since the book was published, the Securities and Exchange Commission passed legislation for allow that, and crowdfunding approaches are now working very well. So I think that's one subject I might talk more about, is how does an entrepreneur gain access to capital? And there are multiple ways to do that. And I talk about raising capital in the book, which I think is a sort of required utility belt tool of any entrepreneur.
In one of the chapters in the book, you mentioned lessons we can learn from leaders of our time, like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and I want to take a minute or two to enumerate on some of the lessons we can learn from some of these people. So starting with Elon Musk, you know, what's something that you know you took away from him that is applicable to entrepreneurs?
I mean, first of all, I interview and spend time with these five great CEOs and entrepreneurs, and all of them had in common doing something because they were passion driven. And you know, Elon talks about starting Tesla and SpaceX not because he wanted to compete with the Defense Department and the and Detroit, but because the product sucked and he wanted something better.
What's something about Elon that we don't know about him?
Well, so he's a fundamental physicist, and one of the things he does is he goes and he looks at the boundary conditions. So he'll go and he'll look at what is the state of possible, not what exists, but what could exist if you could get it there. And so he'll look at looking at batteries, for example. He'll look at what's the supply of lithium on the planet? What is the cost of taking it out of the ground? And then he'll say, batteries should be a lot cheaper. They should be a lot more plentiful. So it's that fundamental first principle thinking that I found most compelling about him.
What about Richard Branson? What's something we don't already know about him?
So Richard, one of the things that he's extremely good at is reducing risk. So for example, you might think that Richard's a huge risk taker, but the fact of the matter, he designs his startups and he's, I forget the exact numbers. It's on the order of, he's done 500 to 700 startups. 2/3 of them have failed, but, enough have succeeded where he's created an incredible fortune and reputation, and he's an amazing entrepreneur. But what he has is a technique that I think is very, very cool is he starts a company and then he will try and retire the risk. What do I mean by that? When he had Virgin Music, he sold it and he spent the money to create Virgin Atlantic, his first airlines. And he was criticized for saying, how can you give up the music industry and go to the airline industry? It's so risky and so forth. One of the things he did, he bought a 747 from Boeing, but he negotiated the right to sell the airplane back a year later if his airline wasn't working. So he minimized his downside risk. And when Richard fast forward 30 years to the creation of Virgin Galactic, when Richard bought the rights from Paul Allen and Burt Rutan to create Spaceship Two, he then went to Dubai and he sold a third of the company to Abar Investments and recouped his primary investment as he did that. And so he was basically he's since invested more money, but he reduced his capital exposure on building that business.
How about Larry Page? Something we don't know about him.
I think it may not be obvious, but Larry is a massive optimist. He, he's a big he's someone who believes the world is getting better and that there is no problem that can be solved. And he's, and so abundance was right up his alley, and he had recommended that mindset to all of his employees. But one of the things I was most impressed of is he's always asking the question, how do you go bigger? How do you go bigger? He's pushing what people believe is possible. And this concept, which has become embodied in moonshot thinking that's run by Astro Teller at Google X, is where can we go 10 times bigger where everyone else is going 10% bigger? And that mindset is so critical for driving innovation and driving new products and capabilities.
The last CEO, Jeff Bezos, what can we learn from him that we don't already know?
Jeff teaches a great lesson. Jeff Bezos talks about the importance of experimentation. And to roughly quote him, he says, our success here at Amazon is dependent on the number of experiments we do per year, per month, per week, and per day. And if we're not willing to experiment constantly, we're not going to be able to innovate. And if you're going to experiment, you're going to fail. And if you're not tolerant to failure and criticism, then you're not going to succeed. So it's a notion that you need to be constantly experimenting, willing to fail forward, and to be tolerant of that. And the challenge becomes a lot of the large public companies I'm on, I know them very well, are resistant to failure, and they're focused on their quarterly returns. And so they are basically captured by their by the Wall Street analysts, and they can't do what they need to do to really innovate and move forward in a dramatic fashion.
Do you ever worry that people are going bold or thinking bigger, but perhaps in a wrong direction or in a scary direction or going too quickly? And if so, you know, how do you respond to that?
You know, I respond basically that they should stop going and watching Hollywood movies, that we live in a very dystopian mindset that bluntly, you know, the job of today's news media is to deliver their drug, which is negative news, to every, you know, everybody's eyeball in high definition in their living room. And I call, you know, CNN the crisis news network or the constantly negative news network. And the world is actually much better than most people get from watching the news. And I think more than ever, the number of people trying to solve problems is exploded beyond our perception of what was possible. You see, it used to be 1,000 years ago that the only people who could solve problems on a national or regional level were the kings and the queens. And even then, all they could do was, you know, change monetary policy or deploy their troops. And then 100 years ago, the people who could change the world were the robber barons, the industrialists who could build a railroad or a steel mill or libraries. But today, any of us can. Anybody who's really truly committed and has a vision of solving a problem has access to the world's most powerful technologies, plenty of capital. And so we're building a world full of problem solvers, and that gets me excited.
I talk to a lot of people who are similarly excited about the opportunities in technology and in the private sector and super optimistic about the future. But when it comes to politics or government, and especially with, you know, 2016 approaching, they are less optimistic, to put it mildly, in some cases. Where's your stance on that? Are you as optimistic, or are you even optimistic about politics and government and their ability to play a role here?
So the one place I'm less optimistic is about governments, because of a couple of things. Number one, they've been designed to be self-perpetuating. Even a democracy like the United States, there's such an industrial military complex, there's such a, you know, ingrained sets of relationships in the in our current two-party system, that any kind of fundamental change, you know, requires revolution. So it's really hard to do. But I am excited about the fact that a lot of the things we used to require the government to do will soon be done by private companies much cheaper, much more efficiently. What do I include in that? Healthcare. I think that, you know, healthcare will eventually drive towards a zero cost. Education, same thing, where we'll have the world's best healthcare and the best education effectively free. And the current systems, which are so broken, will collapse under their own weight. So
do you think that government and politics will play a smaller and smaller role in the future?
I think it will change. I think it will change. Without having a better example, if you think about the Star Trek universe, where capital will have less and less value. But we're really talking about a 30-year time horizon between now and, you know, the mid 2040s, where we're going to see substantial change in every industry, in every part of our world, includes how we govern. So I don't know how it's going to play out. I just know we're going to be seeing a lot of change.
So I'm going to ask a bunch of rapid-fire questions, but these don't have to be rapid-fire answers, of course. Some of these are asked from our audience. First one, this isn't a rapid answer. If the Harvard president said, hey, Peter, you take over, do whatever you would like with with Harvard and, or picture any, you know, Stanford, any of these universities, what would you do? What were some of the first things you would do?
Find somebody better suited to run it than me. No, it's not my, I mean, I've built two universities, International Space University and Singularity University, and they're very focused on a very specific purpose. I think Harvard and MIT are great. I think that the cost structure for universities today is abhorrent. To have to pay, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. But it serves a bunch of different purposes, and you have to sort of parse out the educational portion, which can be better be done 10, 20 years from now by, you know, virtual reality or AI, whatever the case might be, from the social experience, from the research experience. So it's going to change a lot. And these are very wealthy schools, the three that you mentioned, that I think are going to stick around for a while.
Where do you see AI having the broadest impact in terms of education?
So I think AI is going to eventually become our teacher. It's going to be, you will have a relationship with an AI who is, as a child, watching what you do, where you play, there to always answer questions, there to actually, you know, if you want to learn about a particular element of the human cell, you can put on your VR, AR headset, and your AI will take you into the human cell and show you how it looks and what it does. I mean, God knows, you know, I learned medicine back at Harvard in a somewhat antiquated, you know, with a cadaver and beautiful color photographs. But to be able to learn medicine today in a virtual world or on an iPad where you can strip away layers of muscles and take a ride through a blood vessel and see where it ends up. It's a completely different experiential way of learning. But the fact of the matter is everything we learn is going to be end up being in partnership with AI. It's like when my dad, when I was 8 or 9, didn't want to buy me a calculator because he was afraid I'd become weak in math. And I can imagine that. But the fact is there's always a calculator around, and I can always you know, do the advanced calculations on a calculator. And, you know, having a calculator actually allowed me to learn how to program a calculator. In the future, AI is going to be there as your cognizant partner in thinking through things. You know, the best analogy I have is from Iron Man, where, you know, Iron Man is sitting there with Jarvis and saying, you know, lay out the crime scene and overlay this and overlay that. And you can, within collaboration with AI, do things that would otherwise not be possible.
Yeah. And, you know, how does that extend to how AI might influence relationships? To extend the movie analogy, is a her-like reality foreseeable?
I think we're going to see an increase in intimacy because we're heading towards a world of, you know, of brain-computer interface. And I think we're going to eventually get to a point where with myself and a group or a large community, whatever, I'll be able to share thoughts. And if you can share thoughts in that fashion, there's a level of intimacy that's far beyond what we have today. You know, I fault Star Trek for only one thing, which was making the Borg an evil species. Because I think we're heading towards that, what I call a meta-intelligence, where we are connected. The internet is the, if you would, the neural net, the neural system connecting everybody.
Does any of this scare you in any way?
Nope. It really, truly does not. I am more excited and more optimistic about the future than any time ever. And again, it's looking at the data. It's looking at the fact that even over the last 100 years, while we had World War I and World War II and the Spanish flu and the Vietnam War and all of these things, and hundreds of millions of people died as a result of those, the world has gotten better at an extraordinary rate, where today a child in Mumbai has access to the world's information, where we are on a trajectory over the next 20 years to get rid of extreme poverty on the planet completely, where we make a population healthier and wealthier, and they go into a negative growth rate. I don't think we're going to have overpopulation as a concern. I think we'll eventually have underpopulation as a concern on this planet, where we have the number of people able to solve problems independent of the government is going to skyrocket.
This might be a silly question or silly thought, but bear with me for a second. If, you know, if we look at the things that can't be measured in the by data to some extent, you know, the quality of people's most intimate relationships, are is AI and these innovations only going to, you know, give us more access to focus on these relationships or things that can't be quantified, but are why we live in some ways, you know, the pursuit of passion, pursuit of relationships, or is there some fear that they will, you know, mess with them in some way, or that they will be altered, it will be less of a priority, or?
Well, I'll give you one example. If I asked you, Eric, what were you doing last Thursday when you were happiest? Or what were you doing yesterday when you were happiest, or last month? I mean, very few people can actually, in retrospect, remember what was I doing, what made me happiest on that day, unless it was like, you know, their wedding day or some specific big event that they could find in their calendar. Because we don't actually typically measure our state of happiness. If in a moment, you know, you're in a conversation and you're smiling and I say, are you happy on a 1 to 10? Where are you? You say, I'm a 9. Okay, you can measure it there, but we don't actually typically measure happiness. But for a lot of us, if you ask, you know, what's the purpose of life and what would you like to optimize in your life, happiness is very much there. And so one of the XPRIZEs we're working on, for example, right now is a happiness XPRIZE, which is, can you build the sensors into a watch, into other physiological monitoring devices that actually can reliably measure how happy you are, or consequently how not happy you are? And if we can do that and report that in, you can imagine understanding the things that you enjoy doing and doing more of those, and the things you don't enjoy doing and doing less of those, and actually craft your life. Or if you're CEO of a company, you can say, hey, let's see if this policy increases or decreases happiness in the company, and measure that.
I remember trying or reading about, I think France or something had a gross national happiness, or countries have tried this before to some extent.
Yeah.
Is this radically different from what they've tried?
Well, this is about actually measuring it. If you can't measure it, you can't impact it. And the gross national happiness index in Bhutan, I think, is the country that's done that. It's a quick Google search away to confirm. But anyway, I think it's the fact that the measurement capabilities aren't really there. All you can depend on is like a survey that maybe gets done twice a day versus a physiological measurement. You know when you're happy. You physiologically feel happy. And I think it's a very measurable thing.
You were in academia for nearly a decade, over a decade perhaps?
Yeah, I was in college and grad school for probably 11 years.
Did you ever think you would be doing what you're doing now?
Wow, good question. I think I knew I would always want to do space stuff. I think sometimes I have to pinch myself because feel so grateful and so honored to have the things that I'm doing right now. I'm having a blast, a blast in all that I'm doing. And it's a lot of hard work. I'm go 7 days a week, 24/7 typically. But I love what I'm doing. And it is it's something which there's nothing I would rather not be doing. And that's one of the hard things, that people have to give themselves permission to do the things that they love. And I feel lucky, but you don't get there instantly. You get there by increasing the things you want to do and decreasing the things that you don't want to do.
How do you foresee, you have so much going on already, but, just given your analogy earlier of, you're, I think you said something like you're 9 years old. So extend that analogy to like, what do you want to be when you grow up, so to speak? You know, what companies have you not started yet that you want to start, or what initiatives, are upcoming?
Well, so another fun, great question, but I had two drives through college and grad school, which was opening up space and setting a multi-100-year lifespan. And there's long stories there, but nonetheless. And then I added, on the flip side of the original Ansari X Prize being one, really attacking the grand challenges. And And those three drivers of opening up space, you know, creating a world of extraordinary health and longevity, which is what we all want for ourselves and our families, and then really changing the mindset from people complaining about problems to enabling them to solve problems, I think can fill my plate for a while. So I'm in my stride, and I just want to continue, you know, just driving towards these. And I will have failures, and I will have some successes, and I will just hopefully, you know, recycle the stuff and do more. And the beautiful thing, I think, that's true for a lot of people in the tech world, is that once you have a success, especially if you're some of the folks out there like my dear friend Brian Johnson or Martine Rothblatt or Ray Kurzweil or Elon or Larry Page or, you know, all these guys, and, you know, you have a success, you reinvent an industry, and it's like, okay, what's the next big thing I can do, right? Like, okay, what are the world-changing things can I do? And it's a mix of passion, challenge, naivete, and it's great. I'm on the board of Hyperloop, which is an amazing company, and just was visiting there today. It will be some announcements on the company very shortly, and it's an amazing company reinventing transportation. I mean, there's so many extraordinary, fun, you know, billion person, off the charts Star Trek universe opportunities out there that I think we should never be bored. Boredom makes zero sense to me.
I think, you know, Larry Page is, you know, perfect example he just brought up, you know, with Google and then recently with Alphabet. I mean, it's incredibly inspiring.
It is. It's the most exciting time ever to be alive, Eric, and truly an honor, a pleasure to chat with you. And I hope if my world and the things I do can be inspiration for entrepreneurs, I hope they do. I put out a weekly tech blog. You just go to diamandis.com. You can sign up for that. What's the coolest stuff I'm finding this week? And anyway, I look forward to seeing you soon.
Perfect. Peter, this has been awesome. Just lastly, where can people, any upcoming plugs people should know about? Obviously, you know, they could buy Bold on Amazon. Any other thing our audience should know about you? And do you have any asks of our audience?
Just, you know, the areas you can get involved. If you go to xprize.org, you can get involved in helping us decide where we should be doing future X Prizes. My personal website and blog is at diamandis.com, D-I-A-M-A-N-D-I-S, and you can sign up for my weekly tech blog there. Abundance 360, A360.com is my event that sold out already, but we're thinking about doing a live broadcast of it, so you can find out more going there. And it's just, and of course, if you're really interested in tech and you want to go deep, singularityu.org. Our executive programs are incredible. They're sold out for a year, but they're amazing. And anyway, get involved. It's an amazing time to be alive.
Thank you for taking the time, Peter, and super excited to promote future X Prizes on Product Hunt.
A pleasure, Eric. Take care now.